with flour sacks for sale in the front window and bowling trophies above the apple turnovers. The people of the northern Midlands, the Swedes and Norgies and Danes, apparently hadn't heard about the demise of independent small-town bakeries. Most of their towns had at least one. With a bag of blueberry tarts, I went up Maine to a tin-sided false-front tavern called Michelle's, just down the street from the Cease funeral home. The interior was log siding and yellowed knotty pine. In the back room, the junior chamber of commerce talked about potatoes, pulpwood, dairy products, and somebody's broken fishing rod. I sat at the bar. Behind me, a pronghorn antelope head hung on the wall, and beside it a televised baseball game cast a cool light like a phosphorescent fungus. "Hear that?" a dwindled man asked. He was from the time when boys drew "Kilroy was here" faces on alley fences. "Did you hear the announcer?" I wasn't listening. "He said velocity."
"Velocity?"
"He's talking about a fastball. A minute ago, he said a runner had good acceleration. This is a baseball game, not a NASA shot. And another thing, I haven't heard anybody mention a Texas leaguer in years. It's a bloop double now, I think. And a banjo hitter. Where is he? And what happened to the slow ball? It's a changeup." The man got me interested in the game. We watched and drank Grain Belt. He had taught high school civics in Minneapolis for 32 years. But his dream had been to become a sports announcer. "They put a radar gun on the kid's fastball a few minutes ago," he said. 93.4 miles per hour. That's how they tell you speed now. They don't try to show it to you. Smoke, homer, the high hard one. I miss the old cliches. They had life. Who wants to hit a fastball with a decimal point when he can tie into somebody's heat? And that's another thing. Nobody tattoos or blisters the ball anymore. These TV boys are ruining a good game because they think if you can see it, they're free to sit back and psychoanalyze the team. Ask and I'll tell you what I think of it. What do you think of it? Beans. And that's another thing, too.
Beans?
Names. Used to be players named Butterbean and Big Potato, Little Potato, Big Poison, Little Poison, Dizzy and Daffy, Ice House, Shoeless Joel, Suitcase, The Lip. Now we've got the likes of Ricky and Richie and Reggie. With names like that, I think I'm watching a third-grade scrub team. The announcer said the pitcher had good location. "Great God in Hemlock. He means nibble the corners." But which of these throwing clowns nibbles corners? They're obsessed with speed. Satchel Paige, there's a name for you. Old Satch could fire the pill 105 miles an hour. He didn't throw it that fast very often because he couldn't make the ball cut up at that speed. And sure as spitting, his pitching arm lasted just about his whole life. The man took a long, smacking pull on his Grain Belt. "Damn shame," he said. "There's a word for what television's turned this game into."
"What's the word?"
"Beans," he said. "Nothing but beans and hot air." 11. Were it not for a web-footed rodent and a haberdashery fad in 18th-century Europe, Minnesota might be a Canadian province today. The beaver, almost as much as the horse, helped shape the course of early American history. Some Mayflower colonists paid their passage with beaver pelts, and a good fur could bring an Indian 3 steel knives, or a 5-foot stack could bring a musket. But even more influential were the trappers and fur traders penetrating the great northern wilderness between the Mississippi River and Rocky Mountains, since it was their presence that helped hold the Near West against British expansion from the north. And it was their explorations that opened the heart of the nation to white settlement. These men, by making pelts the currency of the wilds, laid the base for a new economy that quickly overwhelmed the old. And all because European men of mode simply had to wear a beaver hat. That morning in Clearwater County, I was thinking about the beaver after one surfaced near where I had knelt to taste a stream coming from a dark, slick lake leaking spirals of mist. In a narrow strip of sky opening above the brook, A great blue heron somehow got its bulk airborne without snaring immense wings and long dangling legs in the close mesh of branches. The lake was Itasca, and the stream, a 12-inch deep rush of cold clarity over humps of boulders, was the Mississippi River. I crossed it in 5 steps. The father of waters, beginning a 2,000-mile journey to join the source of all waters, was here a newborn, small and pure. The name Itasca, despite its Indian sound, came from 2 Latin words, veritas caput, true head, that Henry Rowe Schoolcraft assembled. Schoolcraft, led by the Chippewa Yellowhead, traced the Mississippi to Itasca in order to settle an old dispute about the source of the river. The fact is, several ponds feed Itasca. He recorded in his log that the area was full of voracious, long-billed, dyspeptic mosquitoes, and another explorer wrote that a swarm extinguished his lantern flame. A century and a half later, the dark timbers still sounded with their whine. Their proboscises were still alarmingly large and powerful. With every swat, I splattered a dozen bloody bugs over pants and shirt. An ordinary mosquito can penetrate the tough scutum of a rattlesnake, but Northwood species can pierce the rind of stones. Highway 200 took me eastward into the forest, past No Name Road. Late spring had been creeping north, and suddenly that day it pounced. Nobody was ready for the 82 degrees. At Walker, on the south shore of Leech Lake, I stopped at the county museum. It was closed, but the handyman, John Day, let me in to fill my water jugs. He was half Chippewa and half French, and his son was legal counsel to the litigious Chippewa tribe living on the big reservation here. Day had been in the 5th assault wave on Iwo Jima, and still limped from shrapnel he caught on the island. "This could be July," he said. "It can hit 105 in July, and 45 below in January. 150 degrees of temperature is how we keep the riffraff out. When that doesn't do it, then it's up to the mosquitoes and leeches. If it wasn't for them, and another thing or two, this piece of God's country would be overrun with people." I took a slug of cold water from my jug and nearly choked. I'd just found one of the other things, drinking water that tasted like a mouthful of raw pig iron. Day said, "You see?" He had retired from his job as a school custodian and lived now on Social Security, a Marine disability pension, and another from the school system. He worked at the museum for the occupation of it. "I never worried about making a living," he said, "but I've done thinking about making a life. It's hard to know the difference sometimes, but it must be getting harder, judging by all them that don't know the difference now." "What is the difference?" "Best way to tell it is that if you're trying to make a killing, what's going to get killed is your life." The highway out of Walker went through Whipholt, past the roads to the Indian towns of Boy River, Federal Dam, and Ball Club. The land alternated between marsh and aspen woods filled with white blossoms of wake robin. I came to the Mississippi again at Jacobson and stopped to get off the hot asphalt. The river was wider here, and it took me 3 attempts to shy a rock across. I walked up along the banks. The Mississippi, not 100 water miles from its source, already flowed in olive murkiness. Late afternoon. Downtown Duluth, if you ask me, hangs a little precariously to a volcanic bluff that drops 600 feet to Lake Superior. The city revived in cool air that began to move off the blue lake stretching far eastward, finally so blending with sky that a horizon was almost indiscernible. It was as if Duluth sat on an edge of infinite blueness. The largest freshwater lake in the world, its volume is considerably greater than all the other great lakes combined. Superior is so big, it has a 3-inch tide. Before the St. Lawrence Seaway made Duluth the most western Atlantic port, people used to say it was an old maid city, looking under the bed each night for an ocean. Now Duluth has its ocean, and some citizens dream of a new Chicago here, although a lake that can freeze over for 20 miles out 1/4 of the year is something of a hindrance. On Superior Street, I ate smoked Cisco, then crossed the bridge above St. Louis Bay
into Superior, Wisconsin, then down broad and empty Belknap Street, running from the ore docks, past old walk-ups and corner taverns, on to Route 35 and out of the city. It was dark when I turned south, and I couldn't find a place for the night. Patterson State Park drove me away with a board full of regulations. The map promised Moose Junction, Dairyland, Cozy Corners, towns that proved either no longer to exist or to be three houses in a barn. Somewhere in Douglas County, I began falling asleep at the wheel. I pulled up a side road. Combing fingers through my dusty hair, my thumb struck a growth near my temple. I pushed back the hair and looked in the mirror. A goddamn tick. Another of those little things that keeps the riffraff out of God's North Country. I tweezered it out, undressed, and looked for more. One crawling my leg, one my shirt. I put a match to them. If you pull a tick in the first couple of hours, you have little to fear from the transmission of blood-borne diseases. So they say. Lying atop the sleeping bag in the hot night, I heard the first mosquito. I put the screens in place, but it was too late. Under the pinching bites, I lay sweating and cursing. Unable to stay awake driving, now I couldn't sleep lying down. I was living someone's nightmare. "These are the days that must happen to you," Whitman says. It was here during the Depression that Douglas County, after acquiring through tax delinquencies thousands of acres of logged-out land, offered a homestead plan intended to relieve unemployment in the cities and put the land back to use. You could buy an acre for $2 cash or $3 on time. The land sold, but mostly to people who already had it. Of the few new residents moving in for a try at reclaiming the clear-cut barrens, not a single one was an unemployed city dweller. A generation later, trees had returned, but not many people. Hunting a cool spot in the bag, swatting the 30th mosquito, I understood why. Finally, I gave up and pulled off the screens, and with windows wide open, drove flat out down the highway to blast away the insects. At Danbury, I parked by the town hall, put the screens in place, and again went to bed. I slapped a mosquito and fell asleep. Before I left home, I had told someone that part of my purpose for the trip was to be inconvenienced so I might see what would come from dislocation and disrupted custom. Answer: severe irritability. 12. Without ever getting out of my rig the next morning, I left bleak Danbury for Blue Highway 77 and what is left of the Wisconsin Northwoods. West of Minong, at a small lake, I packed a knapsack, pulled on a swimsuit, and went up the shore to a wooded inlet for a cold, brief swim with a bar of ivory, it floats, to scrub out everything that wasn't me. I built a little fire, cut some sausage, and put it in the skillet with two eggs. The pine popped and snapped in the flames. The sausage hissed like serpents. The warm air moved, and I was washed. Nights like last night made for mornings like this. I could stay on the road forever. Scouring the skillet with wet sand, I heard a branch crunch behind me. I turned and stepped back into the lake. At the tree line stood a man in a fringed buckskin coat and a leather hat pulled low. An open knife glinted in his left hand. I was armed with a collapsible Boy Scout skillet. He raised his arm, the knife flashing again.
"Been watching you," she said.
The knife was the cellophane of a hostess ding-dong.
"Camping here?"
"You startled me to hell." I stepped out of the lake.
"Want some coffee?"
"It makes my arms break out." She spoke fast, and her movements were jittery. Pushing back her hat, she scratched a forehead swollen with mosquito bites. "Did you sleep in the woods last night?" I asked.
"I don't know. Maybe. Why?"
"You've got bites." I folded the skillet and put it away as she took a can of Pepsi Cola from her backpack, opened it, and flipped the tab in the lake. Fish swallow those tabs and cut their guts open, so who cares? Are you some big environmentalist? I picked up my gear. A perfect morning disappearing before a bug-bitten teeny bopper. I doused the fire.
"Like, I was into ecology," she said, "but it got boring.
She looked uneasy.
You're leaving?
Moving on. I hiked to the truck, washed the windshield, did a U-turn, and there she stood along the highway. Now she looked frightened.
Hey, sir, going toward Green Bay?
So who cares? I drove off, turned around at the top of the hill, and came back. She stood there, a pitiful mess of mosquito bites and stringy hair. Are you asking for a lift?
I guess.
She was frightened, all right. Do you live in Green Bay? She shook her head. Look, I'm not picking up some teenage roadie unless I know what you're doing. I kept checking the rearview mirror. Where do you live?
Eau Claire.
She was trying not to cry. What are you doing up here?
Come on, man!
I put the truck in gear. Her face red with rage, she screamed, I split! What's in Green Bay? She took a few steps up the road.
Christ! I don't need a ride this bad.
And I don't need your trouble. I put the van in gear again. Through gritted teeth, she said,
My grandmother's in Green Bay.
I checked the rearview mirror again. The truth was I thought she might be the bait on some scam.
Hey, she said, I'm the one supposed to be scared.
Don't know how far I'm going,
so who cares?
She got in, and I couldn't prevent one more glance at the mirror. Parents file charges against unemployed man. Her name was something like Stacy McDougald, and she had run away 2 days earlier with another girl, who returned home by bus after the first night. Stacy then hitched a ride with a boy who brought her down the back road.
He never said anything, but when he stopped by the lake, I got scared and ran. He looked for me in the woods and stuff, but the mosquitoes were like real terrible, so he gave up.
She had hidden in the trees all night, eaten a couple of ho-hos, and finally put her head in the knapsack to escape the very mosquitoes that had saved her.
Sorry, my clothes are so gross.
She took a vial from her jacket. Only three left. Vacantly, she stared at the vial, shook out a pill, and swallowed it with a swig of Pepsi. What's the pill?
Gotta take them. I'm hyperactive. They're lewds.
The vial had no label. Prescribed?
Oh, sort of. Like they used to be. I took Ritalin when I was little.
Have you eaten anything besides the kitty junk and quaaludes?
If I eat too much, I get gross and fat.
East of Hayward, we drove into resort country, where billboards and small tacky motels lined the highway. The pavement rose and dropped, up and down, and the van rode like a cockboat. The girl fell asleep. At Park Falls, I stopped for gas. She woke up and disappeared into the restroom with her backpack. She came out wearing clean clothes, her long blonde hair wet and tied behind. Except for the insect bites, her face was smooth and bland and of an unnatural pallor, like the underside of an arm. I suggested she telephone her grandmother, but she refused. At Fifield, we went east toward Minocqua. The Chequamegon Forest was trees and sandy soil, blooming with trillium.
Can you tell me why you took off?
I guess.
I mean, so who cares?
She opened another can of warm Pepsi and, furtively, took another pill. This one from a labeled bottle. Boasting of Ritalin and Quaaludes, she hid her Midol.
Angus lost his ass in a taco franchise, and things got really bad at home. I mean, you know, the business got worse, and me and Kevin started catching hell worse.
Who's Angus and Kevin?
Black Angus is my dad. Kevin's my brother. Anyway, like, Angus was losing it. I mean, he'd always find an excuse to beat up on us, like maybe a low grade or using a butter tub lid for a frisbee in the house. So he'd punch us because he was losing his ass.
Like, Kevin's real smart. I mean, he aced everything. If he messed up a test, Angus would slap him around and pull his hair. Call him things like donkey and yellow belly. Anyway, the night his partners and him gave up the franchise, Black Angus's face started twitching like it does when he's tense. Mom told us to look like we were studying, even if we weren't.
God. 2 days later, he was trying to parallel park, and Kevin didn't tell him he was getting close to a pole, and Angus dented the fender. Right there in the shopping center, he starts yelling and slapping Kevin.
Kevin didn't say anything then, but he ran off that night. He's in New York now, but I'm the only one that knows where. He's into Hare Krishna.
He's had a hard go of it.
When he was little, he fried out on acid. Then he found Jesus. He saw Jesus in a phone booth.
A telephone booth?
He said Jesus was arguing with the operator for cutting off his call to God. He wrote last month and said he couldn't communicate with me anymore unless I dumped my false values. I told him that was cool, but I don't know what my false values are. I mean, like, I'm not into first promise rings.
We turned south onto U.S. 51 at Minocqua. Motels and restaurants gimmicked up like barns and country stores the whole way. Most had gift shops, and some had caged animals for petting. Then the supper clubs, each named after its owner. Looking for the land again, I turned east at Merrill.
"I'm not going to ever get married," the girl said. "But if I do, and Mom says don't marry the guy, I won't. I mean, if she'd listen to Nana, I'd be somebody else's kid."
"Angus won't be around forever."
"Nana says Angus never forgave us kids for changing his life. We kept him from becoming a famous writer. But Nana says it's because he was too scared to really do it on his own. I mean, he can't even get to work without Mom. But he likes people to call him Big Mac. It's all bullshit. The only way he's big is pushing little people around."
"He must have treated you fairly sometimes."
"Yeah, like he calls us $100,000 jerks because he read that's what it costs to raise a kid. Or he calls us unfeathered two-legged arguments for abortion. Anything good we did, he played it up to make himself look good. Always himself. He's got a drawing of himself dressed like Superman by his chair, and like all the time he lectures us for being conceited. He doesn't know anything about us. Kevin's not conceited. He hates himself."
"Time for lunch." She didn't hear me. She couldn't get all the bane out.
"Kevin used to call him Anus. I guess you know what that is. One night Anus heard him say it, and he slapped him around pretty bad. Later, Kevin was laying on his bed crying. Then he starts laughing. I got scared. I thought he was freaking out. I go, 'What's wrong?' And Kevin goes, 'I'm hungry.' I go, 'Jesus. I mean, he had blood and stuff on his shirt.' And he goes, 'Yeah, I just had a Big Mac attack.' God, we laughed."
While we were eating, she said, "Last year when I started going out on dates alone, Angus would always say to me before the guy got there, 'This is gross. Just remember, a stiff prick has no conscience.' He said that every time I went out. The other night when he said it, I screamed at him. I couldn't take it anymore. I mean, it's so sick. He started punching me with his thumb, and he told the guy I couldn't go out. That was cool, because the guy was kind of a nerd. I guess I finally got to where Kevin got. I split that night."
She nibbled a French fry, then said abruptly, "Hey, can we change the subject? I mean, like, what are you doing in Wisconsin?"
I gave a half-minute outline. She looked at me absently and said, her curiosity easily satisfied.
"If you took me on to Green Bay, you could get the ferry across Lake Michigan. You wouldn't have to drive through Chicago. Please?"
I agreed to it, although now I would be across Wisconsin without really seeing Wisconsin. Later, as we drove along State 29 through the moraine country of dairy farms and fine old barns, across the Embarrass River, it occurred to me that I had seen something of Wisconsin. What I hadn't seen was the Wisconsin of my Blue Highway preconceptions. Little is so satisfying to the traveler as realizing he missed seeing what he assumed to be in the place before he went. At Green Bay, the smell of Lake Michigan blew in strong. The girl directed me to her grandmother's house. When we arrived, she became excited and jumped down and ran to the bungalow. Then she ran back to the truck.
"Hey, what's your name?"
I told her.
"Okay, keep on trucking."
Ghost dancing seemed empty, and I was lonely, as I was after every rider left who shared some miles. It would pass, but for a while the quiet always bothered me. Kewaunee, sitting on the eastern base of the peninsula that separates the inlet called Green Bay from the open lake, had a business district just a few feet above the water, with homes 100 feet higher on sheer cliffs
that dropped to the shore. It was as if someone had broken a mixing bowl in half, built a toy town in the bottom, and put little houses on the rim. At the ferry slip, I checked the schedule. I didn't want a night crossing, but I could take one at noon the next day. On a breakwater near where Father Marquette celebrated a mass in the 17th century, I ate a sandwich as killdeer made long glides down along the beach. I was quite alone. 13. There's something to be said for banal conversation. After paying the grocery clerk for the yogurt, I commented, "It's a fine day." She smiled. "Anything else?" "That's it, thanks. I'm taking the ferry today." With a nod, she went back to stamping prices on aspirin bottles. I walked to the breakwater to eat breakfast. A man was fishing. "Any luck?" "None." "What are you fishing for?" "Perch." "What's your bait?" "Minnows." And so on. When I ran out of questions, the exchange was over. Across the central north, conversations had been difficult to strike up. The people were polite but reserved. Often they seemed afraid of appearing too inquisitive, while at other times they were simply too taciturn to exchange the banalities and clichés necessary to find a base for conversation. When I walked the north towns, people, wondering who the outsider was, would look at me, but as soon as I nodded, they looked down, up, left, right, or turned around, as if summoned by an invisible caller. "Stranger," Whitman says, "if you passing meet me and desire to speak to me, why should you not speak to me?" I even tried my old stratagem of taking a picture of a blank wall just to give a passerby an excuse to stop and ask what I could possibly be photographing. Nothing breaks down suspicion about a stranger better than curiosity, except in the north. Whatever works better there, I didn't discover. The effect on me was that I felt more alone than I ever had in the desert. I wished for the south, where any topic is worth at least a brief exchange. And so I went across the central north, seeing many people, but not often learning where our lives crossed common ground. At noon, the ferry rocked Kewanee with her air horns and pulled into the slip just as one had done since 1892. She was the 360-foot Viking, built in 1925 and converted from steam to diesel-electric in 1965. The boat swallowed a batch of boxcars, a few automobiles, then ghost dancing, small against the big steel wheels of the railway cars. Pivoting like a compass needle, the Viking made a 90-degree turn in the harbor, sailed past the stubby lighthouse, and cut a straight line over the smooth water toward Alberta, Michigan. The temperature dropped 20 degrees, and the water changed from occluded green to indigo. No one is pulling 300-pound sturgeon out of Lake Michigan, as the Indians once did, but municipal pollution and industrial contaminants have been reduced significantly since the 60s, and sport fishing is coming back. Yet levels of insecticides, PCBs, and mercury are still too high to allow resumption of commercial fishing. On the aft deck, I took a seat and watched Wisconsin get smaller. I had long wondered whether all shorelines disappear on a clear day in the middle of Lake Michigan. The name means big water. I would soon find out. When the ferry had loaded at Kewanee, an infestation of gnats and midges had swarmed in, and with maddening accuracy whizzed into eyes and ears. But once we were underway, thumb-sized flycatchers flew aboard and hopped and flitted and ran down the bugs. One bird alighted on the arm of my chair, cocked an eye at me, nipped a midge, wiggled its minuscule mustache, peeped, and flew to the next chair. I was guessing the number of gnats it took to fill a flycatcher's belly, an organ that can't be any larger than a pinto bean, when a man at the rail pulled an unshelled peanut from his pocket and set it on the deck to lure another bird. "The peanut's almost as big as the bird," I said. He just looked at me, his brown eyes shining like pocket-worn chestnuts, his head a creased leathery bag that might have been dug from a Danish peat bog. The man took a seat and explained that flycatchers followed the ferry from shore to shore. "The peanut is a joke." He lived in Muskegon and had been visiting a daughter in Menominee. Born in Bavaria, He immigrated to Detroit with his mother in the 30s. For a number of years, he had operated a double-crank toggle fender stamping press at Chrysler Motors. "She push 1,000,000 pounds against steel to make the fenders, but the boom, boom, boom damaged the heels." He pulled his large Buddha ears. There came a terrible clanging from below, and I said I hoped the boxcars hadn't crushed my van. His eyes widened, and he said, "Boxcars? I tell you, boxcars." There followed a long and tangled tale, full of details about the old German rail system and about trout fishing. The essence, as I understood it, was this. Carl, he so called himself, a boy of 14, went fishing with a comrade. They caught 4 trout, but it took all day to do it. In the growing dusk, they chose to use the railway tracks as a shortcut home. The comrade had heard the route was easy if you weren't frightened of trestles over 4 deep gorges. The boys soon came to the first bridge. Hoping not to meet a train at mid-bridge, they crossed as fast as they could. It was terrifying to look between the ties.
"On the bridges," he said, "there's no place to go if train is coming."
Trying not to look down, they crossed the second one. The tracks went into the forest and came out again to the 3rd gorge, deeper than the 2nd. They crossed quickly and again went into the forest and out to the last bridge. By that time it was too dark to see even their feet.
"Behold, Hans, in field our way. A cause almost. A big light blind us."
It was a locomotive rounding a curve. The boys turned and started back, but they couldn't hop from tie to tie quickly enough in the dark. Only one thing to do. Laying poles and fish across the timbers, they slipped between the ties and hung by their arms. The engine, roaring above, knocked cinders in their eyes and nearly shook them loose. The cars kept coming, coming. Then the last clacked over. They started to pull up, but their arms were too tired.
"They can only hang like chickens at market."
The comrade tried to swing his feet up, but nearly lost his grip, so they hung and argued whether to drop, in hopes of hitting the river.
"When we cross, we are not afraid to take a chance to die, but when we hang, we become afraid to take chance to live. Life is so."
"How long can a boy hang by his arms?
When it is all things you hang for, who can answer?"
The comrade was in favor of dropping, but he couldn't get the nerve to go first. They settled on a course of yelling alternately every several minutes. They hung, and they hung. The train had shaken the stringer of trout through the ties, and 4 dead fish dangled in their faces.
"If we move, the fishes kisses us."
They kept hanging. The next locomotive would shake them loose.
"I tell my comrade, soon we will be dying."
The boys whimpered, and Carl wished he had been a better son to his poor mother, and had not lied so often to the priests. He promised God he would change his ways. Then a beam from under the bridge played over them.
"Schnell!" we call, and a voice say, "What's this happening here?"
"I see big eyes looking into mine. Eyes blink, and I see a man's face, and it say, 'What are you stupid boys doing?'
We look down and see his boots. He is standing in marsh. We was hanging with our fishes 10 inches off the ground."
Whether the man's story was truth or tale, it had held me. And I had forgotten to see about the shore disappearing from view. I jumped up. We were almost across. It would remain a mystery. When I turned around, the old fellow was gone. The sandy dunes of Michigan glowed pink in the late sun, and at the mouth of the Alberta Harbor there was a marvelous sight. Little slivers of silver jigged on their tails over the blue water. They were alewives, looking for all the world like dancing spoons. These were the fish that had washed ashore to foul beaches in the days of high pollution. The Viking let loose with her horns, the crew tied up and sprinted across the dock and into cars and roared off to supper, and I wished the Viking were sailing all the way to the Atlantic. 14. Some evenings on the road were like this one. East of Alberta, across the Betsy River and down Route 115, I got choosy about where to spend the night. Looking for a town whose primary business was not tourism, I drove on through stands of birch girdled for souvenirs by sightseers, through a countryside of motels and sewer hookup campgrounds. Nothing satisfactory. In an hour, I was unexpectedly on U.S. 27, a limited-access highway. Insisting on multi-access roads and resisting controlled-access living, I had driven right onto a no-U-turn, minimum-speed, tractors-with-lugs-prohibited mainline. I was irritated, but things were to get worse. Through the oil fields of Middle Michigan and into Mount Pleasant with the last drop of light and onto the campus of Central Michigan University, I opened the cooler and found a butt end of bread, a wrinkled orange, and the can of chopped liver. Off I went for a calendared cafe serving Michigan pasties and ended up at an assembly-line sandwich hut. I stood with the other ambulatory digestive tubes, reading the wall-mounted internally lighted menu showing full-color photographic representations of hamburgers and french fries 12 times life-size. A slice of potato big enough to lay steel track over did not look appealing. All prices ended in 9. I ordered and the cash register hummed, spun its mechanism, glared a red number, and an agent pushed me my texturized substitute in its polystyrene sarcophagus. I joined the other diners, some of whose gizzards had already begun wrestling hamburgers named for their weight. Sticky from the heat, I faced another warm night in the truck. I went back to the campus and stopped at an old stone dormitory. Although spring term had ended and summer session hadn't begun, somebody was living in the building. No one around. I heard a noise from a shower room, so I went in and started to call out when I noticed a tampon dispenser. Trespasser jailed. Backing out quickly and quietly, I turned and bumped into a nude body. "What's going on?" A young man's voice. "The person," I fumbled. "The resident assistant. Looking for him." "He's out. What do you need?" "Wanted to buy a shower." "Help yourself. Isn't this a women's dormitory?" "Usually. Right now it's for some businessmen taking a seminar." When I came out of the shower, the student offered a vacant room. It would be cooler. I was almost asleep when the light went on, and in walked a man about 40, wearing a baby blue terry cloth hat, the kind you can wipe a sweating face with, and a blinking multi-mode programmable digital chronograph that gave him a continuous readout on what microsecond, second, minute, hour, day, and month he was currently in, as well as his lap time, split time, and whether he was in first or second place. He set down 2 monogrammed suitcases, looked at me, said nothing, opened a case, undressed, wrapped a personalized towel around his looseness, locked the suitcase, stuck his billfold in his towel six-shooter style, and walked out, leaving the light on. After 10 minutes, I got up and turned it off. He came back smelling of baby powder, turned the light on, studied his fret of a face in the mirror, got his shaving kit, and walked out, leaving the light on. After 5 minutes, I got up and turned it off. He came back, turned the light on, sat down, belched, wiped his tasseled shoes, lighted a Vantage menthol, took out a Consumer Reports, Penthouse, and a plastic binder with North Central Assurance Group or something like that embossed on it. A man laughed in the hallway, and he walked out again. "Larry," a voice said, "you fly in?" "Drove the station wagon." "Say, who's the creep in my room?" "The Jigaboo?" "No, Tonto." "Don't know." I got up and turned off the light. I was almost asleep when the door banged open and a flashlight blinded me. That was it. I jumped up. "What the hell is this? Get that light out of my eyes." "What's your name, buddy?" "Sparkle Plenty. What the hell's going on? Are you registered?" "I'm not a communist. What is this?" A blinking readout reached over and switched on the light. Larry had brought a watchman. I explained the student's invitation, but the watchman didn't believe it and told me to get out. I pulled on clothes and rolled up my sheet, as slowly as possible. As I left, I said to Larry, "Be sure you call Sam Spade here if those 2 beds aren't big enough for your fat ass." "Shut your own ass, you freak." The watchman interrupted the exchange, and I went to the hot truck and lay down in a cold anger. I couldn't get to sleep, so I wrote out a little report. When I finished, I went back and pinned it to the door. Autopsy findings on Larry Anonymous. the examination. It was found that the life of the deceased was given over to the concerns of surety bonding, net profit margins, and total shareholders' equity. As a student of actuarial statistics, i.e., letting the dead tell you where to put your money, the deceased formulated Larry's Law, which has become a leading piece of desk plaque philosophy: risk nothing. Cause of death: acute myocardial infarction due to the continued gathering and piling of material good upon material good and desire upon vain desire, aggravated by an ongoing fear that the deceased would one day find himself without his driver's license and wristwatch. Summary: like a poorly written policy, the primal underwriter has declared this man of trifling sorrows null and void. Respectfully submitted, S. Plenty. 15. Across her t-shirt was Ski. She leafed through Stalking the Wild Asparagus in the college bookstore. I was in the middle of Michigan and looking for a place to go next, so I asked whether she lived in Mount Pleasant, but she didn't look up. I tapped her arm. "I'm from Missouri, traveling. I'd like to find a good place to visit in Michigan." She watched, but said nothing. "Maybe you know a nice spot." She just stared. Northerners really carry taciturnity too far, I thought. A clerk came up and said, "She's deaf, probably having trouble reading your lips." He repeated what I'd asked. She said, "Oh," and put the book down. Holding up her right hand as if to say how, in Hollywood Indian fashion, she said, "Dumb." "Dumb?" the clerk repeated. I didn't know whether she meant me or herself. "Dumb, Michigan," she said, and wagged her right thumb. "Thumb of Michigan?" the clerk asked. The girl smiled, wagged her thumb again, and nodded. "Very beautiful." "It's very beautiful," the clerk translated. Looking at her Ski t-shirt, I said, "Do you ski on the thumb?"
"Thumb's too flat. By Dave's car water ski."
"Thumb's too flat to ski," the clerk said. "Her name's Karwarski." So that was how I ended up on the thumb of Michigan. On a map, Lower Michigan looks like a mitten, with a squatty peninsula between Saginaw Bay and Lake Huron forming the thumb. A region distinctive enough to have a name was the only lure I needed. But also it didn't hurt to have towns with fine, unpronounceable names like Quanacassee, Sebowing, Wajamiga, or other names like Pigeon, Bad Axe, Pinnabog, Rescue, Snover, and what may be the worst town name in the nation, Friedberger. People of the Thumb have come from many places, but Germans and Poles predominate. I headed due east across the flat country, past the great industrial pile of Dow Chemical at Midland, past the Victorian houses in Bay City. Near Quanacassee, canals draining the wetland to make farming possible flanked the highway. In the ditches, mile after mile, violent flashes of polished bronze roiled the murky water. I stopped to see what it was. The hot, muddy banks frothed with the courtship of 18-inch carp. Males flicking Fu Manchu mustaches, metallic scales glittering like fragments of mirrors, orange tails thrashing, did writhing belly rolls over females as they demonstrated the right of their milt to prevail. Away from the bay and lake, Thumbland was agricultural land, sugar beets, navy beans, silage. But on the bay from Caseville to Port Austin, the Thumb was an uninterrupted cluttering of vacation homes, tourist cabins, motels, and little businesses selling plastic lawn ornament flamingos and used tires cut into planters. The houses and cabins and businesses pressed in tightly, and in the few places where beach delivered itself to the road were no trespassing signs. Whoever called Americans a rootless people never saw the west shore of the Thumb, where houses used 8 weeks a year block off the lake every day of the year. If Americans are truly rootless, why weren't a few lodges and hotels built to leave the shore undeveloped, as the rooted Europeans might do it? As it is, the rootless family drives up from Ypsilanti to spend its allotted time cutting grass, painting the boathouse, and unplugging the septic tank. But the northeastern shore was another story. Open. Farms and fields came down to the edge of Huron, and the people had collected into towns, rather than stringing out along the lake. If West Thumb land was unrestrained America, the East Thumb was the best of rural England, settled, yet uncongested. Harbor Beach, a factory village and a pleasant one, had both a harbor and a beach inside a long stone breakwater. It also had a plant manufacturing plastics, one making food seasonings, and another producing pharmaceutical goods, as well as a big power station. People who argue that pretty towns and industry cannot live together should look at Harbor Beach. A very long wooden pier ran out toward the breakwater. That Friday evening, the whole village must have been fishing from it. Although nobody was having any luck, the night before, a crazy run of perch had swum in. "This water was something to see," an angler said. He had that blankness of expression that comes only from years of watching 8-pound test monofilament disappear into placid water. "Fish assaulted our bait." He usually fished for whatever was running, perch, steelhead, chub. In the winter, he opened the ice and fished for pike. Most of his life he had worked in Detroit as a machinist, turning parts for gasoline blowtorches. Now kids don't know what a gas blowtorch is, but they were beautiful things that built the country. Precision brass fittings machined to critical tolerances, blew like thunder and ran like steam engines, and they lasted forever because they were designed and built, and not just assembled. The throwaway propane bottle put us out of business. Those things are designed as junk and built accordingly. But the true blowtorch? A son inherited his dad's torch. I loved the work because I knew somebody would keep what I made. He reeled in a nibbled-over minnow and reloaded. The war changed things. During the 40s, our shop converted to making brake shoes for Jeeps. There wasn't satisfaction in the job except for good money and helping our boys. When the war ended, things began breaking down, you might say, and that's when I and the wife started spending time up here. In 1942, he had bought a small farm on the Thumb. It was a good time to buy because I had money and land was available and going at a low price if you were white. People, you see, were afraid coloreds were going to move in to do war work at the factory, a gunpowder plant, I think it was, so they sold low to whites. It worked to my advantage, but I don't think any coloreds ever came up to work anyway. He jigged his bait and said to the water, "Hello," then reeled in the dead minnow. "I like my role now, of no consequence whatsoever." He looked down the pier for activity. I decided to buy the place up here on a Friday evening similar to this one. Went home from the shop and realized when I got home that I was just waiting for Monday. Funny thing was, I didn't like the job anymore. As he packed up his gear, he asked why I was in Harbor Beach. I told him I was looking for a good hamburger. "That would be the crow's nest if you get out before 10, he said. "Be sure to see the painting. That thing stirs up almost as much commotion as a fast run of perch." 16. At the Crow's Nest, we drank America's only fire-brewed beer, a brew remarkably interchangeable with any other American beer. Maybe that was why a man called Stitch took his strohs with a nip of ginger brandy. He wore coveralls and a herringbone sport coat with a buddy poppy in the lapel. He was old and looked older. Before he lost coherent speech, I heard several things in his gargle of words. This was one. "I got healed when I was 16. Healed in a church basement on Wednesday night. Never been a religious man, but I've been a believer since." "What were you healed of?" "An affliction to bear. I had feet flat as waffles." He told a story about tracking down a pair of coyotes that were eating his mother's chickens. A long tale of the chase he'd recounted many times before. It was one of those events by which a man comes to define himself. No matter where else he'd failed, he'd killed the coyotes. Above the bar hung the painting the fisherman had mentioned. On black velvet was a stacked, shimmering-haired, bronzed-bodied blonde in Indian-styled headband and loincloth. That's all she wore, unless he counted the expression on her face. Just another back bar nude, More silly than indecorous, I thought. I asked the bartender, a comely blonde herself, if the fuss about the painting was due to the mocking of Indian traditions.
Indian traditions? What's with Indians? It's the bare tits, dearie.
I see. Some people have gotten on my case because of a rumor that I posed for it. She stared at the painting as she pulled a draft.
Of course it isn't me. No woman's built like that. Those are fantasy knockers. They look like muscles.
Indeed they did. At 9 o'clock, five post-adolescents with cigarettes rolled in their t-shirt sleeves came in and began setting up a band. They had speakers the size of closets, an amplifier control panel like the Kalamazoo switchboard, a siren to alert all of Lake Huron, enough strobes to light an airfield, and more drums than the Indian nation. I wondered what the group would do if they had to make music from cow bones in a washtub. At 10 o'clock, they cut loose. I saw why I was supposed to be out before 10. I heard the band through my elbows on the bar, heard them against my forehead. The guitarist took off his shirt and flaunted a curved chest, white as the gut side of a catfish. He was singing. I knew that because his mouth opened and closed and he wasn't eating. Sidling to the bar came a fellow in a blue suit large enough for a dancing partner to step in with him. He puffed a Swisher Sweet and didn't cough much. To the barmaid he said,
"Pretty lady, this man's here to boogie."
"Anybody else know that, Shorty?"
Two young women drinking scotch and coke sat and waited to dance. The one with deep, dark eye sockets relentlessly worked a stick of chewing gum. The other, wearing snakeskin knee boots and golden slacks that fit as if gilded to her, was slender and had the eyes of a lynx. Boys in yellowed shirts took her to the dance floor one after another. They were stumps. Dancing out of her pelvis, she swirled around them like smoke, moving across the floor, inching back, sliding away. The siren went off, and the strobes flashed her into a wispy possibility. The boys were dying for her, but they got drunk and sat down. She danced on alone against the amplified drums and moved through the shadows of other dancers. Six college boys from Ann Arbor came in to drink Heinekens, and one had a few turns with the lynx, but only his shoulders and hands danced. No one else even tried. At 11:30, the doors flew open, and a couple dozen people, men wearing plaid slacks, the women billowy dresses, rolled in. I asked the barmaid who they were. "Weekenders, housewives and tenants and things. One guy's a chiropodist. They're the people that never dance with their own husbands and wives." The men moved like the college boys, but with a little more effort and a little less result, while the women assumed strange postures as they danced. One placed both hands between her thighs and pulled her legs back and forth. Another danced with an arm upraised, as if calling for a fair catch. A third moved with arms perpendicular to her body, as though greeting someone just off a boat. But the best danced with hands in pockets, her legs moving as if hot-wired to the drums. In the women there was a desperate sexuality, although I don't think the husbands, unlike the carp in the ditches, knew what was going on. At midnight, a spinning dancer pulled a string at her waist. Her dress billowed open like a parachute, and she stepped out of it and whirled it above her head. She wore a bikini swimsuit made with less material than the washing instructions in her husband's shirt. But the men lost interest as soon as they realized it wasn't her underwear. The noise and smoke finally drove me to cover. When I left, the lynx had at last found a fit partner behind the bandstand, a full-length mirror. And that's what went on one Friday night in May in Harbor Beach, Michigan.
Part 8. North by Northeast.
1. The wipers were useless. A black squall line had moved in so quickly I could only pull off the road until the worst of the storm passed. I was on State 142, just west of the farm town of Bad Axe, and looking for Ivanhoe. Later, when I was, apparently, in Ivanhoe, I had found only a church. So I headed east through Ubley, then down the edge of the Thumb, past more shoreline houses, to Port Huron. The rain eased, but continued. I had to decide. Either the eastward route lay through Detroit, Toledo, and Cleveland, or it was a shorter northeast jog through Canada. I crossed the St. Clair River into Sarnia, Ontario, and stopped at Canadian Customs to assure officials I carried none of this or that, had enough money for my stay, was unarmed, had no live animals, and would be in the country only a few hours. "Describe the purpose of your trip," the inspector said. "Passage. Enjoy it, then." But I didn't. The showers kept at it, the traffic ran heavy, I got lost in London, and again in Brantford. Finally, I was just driving, seeing nothing, waiting to get off the road. But it was a long haul of 250 miles through the province. By the time I reached U.S. Customs, the rain had stopped, and as I crossed the bridge over the Niagara River north of the falls, with quite unbelievable timing, the Canadian sun turned the eastern cliffs orange. I was in New York, land of Texas hots, beef on a wick, and Jenny Cream Ale, where hamburgers are Hamburgs and Frankfurters, Frankfurts. I was also within minutes of running out of gasoline. I took a guess that Lewiston would be a left turn. If not, I was in trouble again. But it was there, looking a century older than the Michigan towns I'd come from. In fact, Lewiston was 2 centuries older, although the oldest buildings now standing were ones built just after the British burned the town in 1813. I filled up next to an old stone hotel where, the gas man told me, James Fenimore Cooper wrote The Spy. "It's some book, they say." "Understand," he added. "Our station wasn't here then." 10,000 miles of blue highways had wearied me, especially after driving the last 300 of them in the rain. I wasn't tired of traveling, and I had no reason to go home, but I wanted to put the wheel aside to get off striped pavement for a few days. Near Canandaigua Lake, a friend I hadn't seen in several years had built a log cabin in the woods. Whether he would be home, I didn't know, but that's where I headed. With what remained of the light, I followed the Niagara River toward Lake Ontario, then picked up New York 93, through Warren's Corners, next to Wright's Corners, through Lockport, an old Erie canal town and former home of merchants gargling oil, good for man or beast, through the old Heinz 57 varieties vegetable farms, onto State 5, and into Batavia, where the old Snake Den Inn of the early 1800s advertised beds with clean sheets only slept in a few times since new, to Leroy, former home of J-E-L-L-O, and on through darkness to the west edge of Canandaigua Lake. I knew the road name where my friend lived and nothing more, so I stopped at a farm on Route 21 for directions. The farmer got me to the road, and the road took me to the house, which was lighted from top to bottom, with no one around but the dogs. I went back to my bunk. Later, when trees obscured the moon, there was an uproar of metallic banging against the ghost. "Hey in there, damn it! Open up this sardine can!" It was my friend. Scott Chisholm said, "I'm not going to wake you up by asking why you're sleeping in my woods. I'm only going to ask you if you want to sleep inside." "Too tired to move." "All right, breakfast is then. I'll tell you only this. I won't be able to sleep knowing you're here. I'm quite harmless." 2. At breakfast, Linda, Chisholm's wife, told me he had slept like a fallen log. "I knew he would," I said, but I liked thinking he thought he wouldn't. Scott Chisholm, a Canadian citizen of Ojibwe and Scotch descent, had lived in this country longer than in Canada, and liked the United States, but wouldn't admit it for fear of having to pay off bets he made years earlier, when he first came over, that the U.S. is a place no Canadian could ever love. He was a teacher in the Empire State College system. In 1975, he built a 2-story log house in the hills west of Canandaigua Lake, the thumb of the Finger Lakes. Chisholm drilled a well and hit sweet water at 35 feet. It produced 6 gallons a minute. Even though a human being needs only a pint of water a day to survive, Chisholm decided his family couldn't live on 8,640 gallons a day. So he drilled to 68 feet and got 14 gallons a minute, 14 gallons of gassy, sulfurous stuff, probably the most American thing he ever did. He and Linda and their two children, Sean and Caitlin, shared the house with a three-legged dog named Teddy, a four-legged dog that had lost